The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 354, Examining Sexual Ethics, Lessons from the Law and the Gospel, a paper by Roger Leishman, with comments by Rebecca Miner.
Of talking about sex and decision-making and moral choices that people make about sex, well, I have to warn everybody that I'm going to use language or terms that are very frank that you should consider it as if you come to the movie South Park, that if you're not comfortable with that level of frankness in language, that you probably shouldn't stay. And as the people come in, if they start blushing, please whisper to them that they're in the wrong movie and that Star Trek Phantom Menace is down the road. Trying to think where to begin. I guess let me start with a quotation that was on Nightline a year and a half ago. It says that in response to this is the day after the Monica Lewinsky's name first appeared in the news. And Ted Koppel said, "The crisis in the White House may ultimately come down to the question of whether oral sex does or does not constitute adultery." What I want to do today is talk about a couple of basic questions which are raised by this statement and by statements like that and Sunstone and elsewhere, drawing on background both as a lawyer and also as a student of the Mormon Church and Mormon religion. I mean, the things that jump out of this, and they'll essentially be the focus of my talk, are the question of what is sex? And then the question of adultery and what are the limits on sex and what kinds of actions should be circumscribed or limited by us, either as a community or as individuals. So I'm going to answer four questions. First, why talk about sex? Second, what is sex anyway? Number three, what is queer sex? Because a lot of the discussion that goes on is trying to identify something other than normal sex, whatever that is. And then finally, I use the phrase, what is bad sex? But in terms of recognizing there are a lot of different ways to characterize actions or conduct of different kinds that are sexual, and a lot of different tools that are useful in talking about them and making choices that you make in your life and as a community. So moving to the first question. I thought about it, and I've come up with four reasons that I think it's worthwhile to talk about sex. One is that sex is very important. I mean, it's sort of a truism, but it's something that's recognized in the law. Sex is very regulated in the law. Last year, the Supreme Court, in a case involving a dentist and discrimination, talked about the idea that reproduction and the life choices related to it are central to life itself. Similarly, in the church, we see many examples of talking about the importance of sex. For example, the provocation on the family. And the quote in Alma, where Alma tells his son that these things, what's the exact phrase? These things are abomination in the sight of the Lord, yea, most abominable above all sins, save it be the shedding of innocent blood or denying the Holy Ghost. So again, whatever these things are like a big deal for us as a culture, for us as a church, for us as individuals. And it's worth talking about. Second point, I think, is sex is interesting. I use that phrase for a couple reasons. One is that you see it in the media, you see it in the Laurel and the Aaronic Priesthood Advisor handbooks. It's a topic that people enjoy talking about. It's important to all our lives. And it's also interesting in another way, in the sense that everybody is affected by it. I mean, everyone, in one way or another, is thinking about sex, having sex, not having sex, here as a result of someone having sex once upon a time, contemplating the future, perhaps having sex or whatever. It's interesting in part because it's one of the few things that is universal, although we have to recognize that people are going to come to it with different needs and different questions. The next thing about sex, which I find very interesting, is that sex is very confusing. I first gave a presentation like this about a year ago. I was teaching at a law school in Chicago. And the reason I did it is when I was in therapy a few years ago, I discovered or I realized that the only time I stutter is when I talk about sex. I like, it is like, it was like, even it's happening to me now, that I will talk perfectly fluently and normally, but whether I'm in bed or in with a therapist or my mother or whatever, I would just become completely tongue-tied. I do a lot of my job, a lot of work with reproductive rights and with things related to sex. And last year, I had a couple of cases where I'm representing women who are being denied access to fertility. And my associate, who's a very smart, very articulate young woman, will purposely like force me to say words like vagina and uterus, and because she knows that I will start blushing. So in response to this challenge, I said, I will talk for a whole hour about nothing but sex. I can do it. I pulled it off. I like was smooth. So this is the part of the reason that it's worth talking to me is why and how can there be something that renders people so inarticulate? And it's not just me. I mean, I looking back at that Alma quote about these things are an abomination, or that people talk in these strange generalities so often and act like everyone knows what we're talking about, but often we don't. It's confusing too because talking about sex really causes people to do irrational things, not merely in what they do, although I think many of us have learned through long experience that sex makes us do strange things, but it also makes us do strange reasoning, where we use arguments that are slippery slopes that we would not allow in another discourse, where we say things like masturbation leads to homosexuality, leads to mass murder, leads to bestiality, inevitably. I mean, in the law, we are suspicious of people who make arguments about saying that because of X, you go to Y and all the way to Z. It also creates a problem with logic in terms of dichotomies, of setting up either-ors, where it's all or nothing. You're clean, you're unclean. You're a virgin, you're not a virgin. This act was sex, it was not sex. And a lot of the time, we're making things black and white, which are not necessarily black and white, or allow us to take shortcuts logically. Finally, and I think that this is especially true in Mormonism, is that sex is confusing because it causes us to lose our sense of proportion. And I think I have a quote from Ronald McElprang, who's a therapist, I believe. But he talks about according to one Mormon therapy patient who was coming there because she had an aversion to sexual intimacy. She said, the most powerful message about sex which she received from her parents was, we would rather see you dead than have you be immoral. And that to me is just the quintessential but typical example of the idea of that we blow this so out of proportion so often that we lose our ability to talk and we lose our ability to think because we are so distracted or blinded by the confusion that we've allowed ourselves to go up about it. Finally, I think it's important to talk about sex because it's something that harm reduction approach is useful. Let me define what harm reduction is. It's a term that comes actually out of dealing with drug addiction and with drug treatment. And there's two basic ways you can go in dealing with drugs. And we also do this with risky sexual behavior. You have something called zero tolerance, where you will not have a policy and you won't allow yourself to say anything that suggests that it's ever possibly okay to use drugs. So you won't allow a needle exchange, even though it's proven that that reduces transmission of AIDS, because you might suggest you're condoning drug use. Harm reduction is an approach that says, I'm not gonna make a decision about whether you're going to do drugs or not, but assuming you're going to do drugs, let's figure out what we can do to reduce the harm to yourself and others that you're doing by doing drugs. Or if my values might be, I don't believe that people should have sex outside of marriage, but if you're going to, let's make sure you know about contraception, that you know about prevention of diseases. The problem often about talking about sex in the church is it's like all sex out of marriage is bad, and sex in marriage is good, and that's it. And we're all like, we can't say anything more about it. And last year I was at Sunstone. I was really disappointed and disturbed by a panel by an openly gay Mormon person who basically came up with a conclusion that it was all or nothing. You were either celibate or you're out there promiscuous with someone different every night, and that there wasn't any in between because there's no possibility of proportionality. There's no way to talk about this and say that, okay, if you've just made a decision that you're not going to wait till you're married or whatever, that there's nothing more to talk about. And what I believe is that it's worth continuing to talk about sex. So turning to my next question, which is, what is sex? I'm going to take an example of, I guess it's 20 questions. But let me say, it describes 20 activities. I think 5 of these are sex, but you may have your own count. But let's take a survey. Yes or no, sex or not sex? Number one, male coworker brushes female colleague's breast. Sex, not sex? No. Husband performs oral sex on wife. Sex, not sex? Good. 4 Boy Scouts masturbate in a circle at camp. Not sex. Sex. 1 Boy Scout masturbates alone in the tent. Sex? Not sex. A online user has orgasm while participating in cyber sex. Sex? Not sex. He fakes an orgasm while having phone sex. Is that sex? Okay. Monica performs fellatio on Bill. Sex. Really? Al performs fellatio on Bill. Sex? Okay. 2 boys kiss. Not sex. A brother and a sister kiss. Gross, but not sex. A man and a woman French kiss. Not sex. Okay. Okay. Margaret takes photographs of while Stephen watches 6-month-old Hugo. I have a picture of this, actually. Sex? Not sex. Oh, two women French kiss. Okay, sex. Really? Sex, not sex. Margaret takes a picture. Sex, not sex. Well, we'll get there. I'm just saying what yours is now before we get to mine or your. Charles Dodson takes photographs of 10-year-old Alice Liddell naked. Okay. For $80, Wolfgang ties up Pat with socks while talking dirty. Wolfgang is actually the nom de sex of my childhood best friend, who is he's actually a bureaucrat, but on the side he like has a dungeon in his spare room. Sex, not sex. Not sex. John penetrates Pat's anus with John's penis. Sex, not sex. Sex. Chris penetrates with strap-on dildo. Sex. Dr. Lines penetrates Rosemary with gloved finger. Vagina with rosemary. That's sex. Feral. Frat boy touches breast of unconscious co-ed after putting something in her drink. Not sex. That's a crime. BYU fiancé sleeping in bed together with their pants on but without their shirts. Sex or not sex? I'm not saying is it bad. Is it sex or not sex? Okay. Before we answer the question I presented of what is sex, let's talk about different ways we can. I mean, we looked at a bunch of conduct and a bunch of attitudes about conduct, and people had an intuition about what was sex, what was sexual but not sex, and what was not sexual at all. On that list, in my personal definition, 5 were sex, 14 were sexual, and 1 was not sex, and that was Dr. Lyons. Does anyone know what that means? Only if you've been to a previous presentation. One thing it could mean is it's the American Sign Language's letters B, O, and D. But it's actually, it's one of those trick questions. It's actually a talk about what is sex from the point of view of anatomy. The answer to that is there are a bunch of body parts and things which are surfaces. And there are a bunch of things which are orifices, and there are a bunch of things that you can put into orifices. And some things can show up in different places, like your fingers can be, you can stick them in things, but you can touch them. I mean, so you sort of like have one of these column A, column B things. Like, so you take your lips and you touch your face. That might be sexual, might not be sexual. You take your nipples and you stick them in your nostril. Sex, not that's sex. Or you touch them. You take your toes. You put them in your navel. I mean, part of what we mean by when we talk about sex is a bunch of body parts which are used in one of 3 ways. And again, they can serve different purposes. Another way we can talk about what sex is by your attitude about what you're doing. And here's an example from the law, where we talk about a crime. You do something, but you do it with a certain mental attitude. So, for example, let me, for this I have to remember, since that's been like 10 years since I had criminal law. Let's use the example of getting pregnant. So strict liability means you inserted a penis in a vagina and you got pregnant. And it doesn't matter why you did it or what you were thinking, you're pregnant. Negligence is when you do something without... So, for example, you bought some condoms which were like the package says that they're expired and they're defective, but you didn't really pay attention. And so you got pregnant. Same result, but it was because there was an accident. Recklessness is when you disregard it. So you saw the news report about the defective condoms, you bought them anyway. That's kind of reckless. Knowingly is when you know there's a hole in the condom and you use it anyway. But you didn't mean to get pregnant. You didn't want to get pregnant. You just weren't really like doing what you should have known better. Purposely is when you don't use the condom at all and you're having sex because you want to get pregnant. You may or may not get pregnant, but that's what you do. And finally, specific intent is when you do it for a particular purpose. So you're having sex, you want to get pregnant, and it's because you want a boy. And so the focus here. So I use this as an example about when you talk about sex, like the difference between brushing the coworker's breast versus like falling into her and like groping under her shirt or something. I mean, there's a very difference between a level of what you intended and why you did it. And that's a big part of what we mean by sex, is of what's going on in our minds. Another way of framing that is ideas about reality, of what you believe to be true. And here I'll use the example of adultery. The question of someone's married. So you're having sex with a person, and you are imagining that they're married. Is that adultery? What if you know that person is married? Is that adultery? What if that person isn't married, but you believe they're married? Is that adultery? And you want to have sex with this person because you believe they're married. Is it adultery if you have no idea whether they're married or not? And finally, does it matter? Like reality, like platonic ideals. Is it adultery whether the person's actually married or not, regardless of what you think? Again, that's one way to look at the ideas of what sex is. Another way to talk about sex, and this like comes back to my cyber examples, of are you doing it? Are you seeing it? Are you talking about it? Are you remembering it? Are you hearing it? I mean, is it sex if we're standing opposite of the room talking about having sex in the past? I mean, sex is very much a mental thing, and it's some conduct, which is clearly sexual, does that. So anyway, back to my question of what is sex? Let me give a couple examples three different kinds of definitions of sex. First, a couple ones from the law. For example, in Illinois, which is where I practice law, sexual intercourse is when there is any penetration of the female sexual organ by the male organ, and penetration means any contact at all, however slight. So that in Illinois, that's the only thing that's sexual intercourse. I mean, so if you thought oral sex was sex, not by that definition, it's not. So now, in the criminal law, which is broader, we talk about a difference between sexual conduct and sexual penetration. So this is in the context of like child abuse or rape. So sexual conduct, some things you do are touching with a purpose of sexual gratification. And sexual penetration, which is a worse thing, like rape of a child is worse than abuse of a child. And there it's the kind of penetration, but it's not just a vagina and a penis, it's other kinds of penetration. And lawyers are we're so into like useless language and definitions. I know I'm going quickly, actually I have like a handout copy of this if anyone would like them, but I'm trying to say as much as possible. Here's some definitions of sex. This is like, we have a crime in Illinois of sexual exploitation and psychotherapy. And for the purpose of this, sexual contact, which is illegal, includes requesting that your patient or former patient touched you. You don't have to actually have her touch you, but requesting her is sexual conduct. Or if she touches you, if you agree to it, you're the therapist, and you agree to it, that's sex. But if you touch her, whether you agree or not. So, I mean, we're talking about different kinds of it's the same action by the same people, with the same body parts for the same purpose, but we're mixing and matching those things. Here's a couple of LDS definitions of what sex is. This is from Elder Scott a couple of years ago. Intentional conduct of the sacred private parts of another's body. Again, we all want our. I'm a gay man, and I have absolutely no sensation in my nipples. So to me, breasts are not a sacred private part of my body or my boyfriend's body. But other people have different attitudes about that. But anyway, I don't know what Elder Scott meant. This is from Dallin Oaks' Same Gender Attraction. The reason I include this is because he talks about how feelings, thoughts, and actions. And you're not responsible for feelings, but thoughts are something you're responsible. So you can have sexual thoughts, which are sexual conduct. And finally, here's a definition of same sex. Using your body for erotic purposes. So I don't know what that is, but those are some definitions. So I want to close this section by offering what I really want to say is that people have intuitive definitions that you operate from about what is sex, what is something that's sexual but not really the same as sex, and what is not sex at all. JAMA is the Journal of American Medical Association. They reported a study. They asked 600 college-age students what they thought was what sex was. And this is 59%. They thought oral sex was not sex. And 20% of these thought that anal sex between a man and a woman is not having sex. And I have a friend who, she and her boyfriend, she wants to stay a virgin. So she's been only having anal sex. But as long as she doesn't have sexual intercourse, she thinks she's still a virgin. And, I mean, she is to her. Monica, this is a quote from a phone conversation with Linda Tripp. We didn't have sex. We fooled around. We had oral sex. Having sex is having intercourse. Jim, Grover, Greg, and Roger are four gay friends who had dinner at Christmas, and I asked them in preparation for this, what is sex? Jim says, if someone has an orgasm, and I say, well, what about like by yourself on the phone? He says that their contact is required. Grover's is very broad, any genital contact. Greg says sex means penetration. This is, as you might guess, lesbians don't count, so it's all about penetration. Whether it's penis, it's all about penises. This is the law is very all about penises too. I mean, if you wondered, it's really all about penises. This is my definition, which I've come to after years of thinking about it. Sex is non-incidental genital or anal contact. I've eliminated the breasts from the picture because they're not important to me, and it's non-incidental because it means that you have to do like mean it. It's not like you just brushed. So you can be lying in bed naked, but that's not sex. But anyway, that's my definition. Well, my friend Cammy, who's an LDS woman, says that I'm totally going about it wrong. That the definition is sex is what you have to confess to the bishop. So that's whatever that is. That's what sex is, and that's her definition of sex. This is and I agree. And what I'm saying here in start am I talking about what is sex? Is I think it's really important that we're so sloppy about these definitions, and yet we all have these intuitive answers when I put up those questions of what we think sex is, and what we think like something completely non-sexual is, and we need to recognize what those are, examine them, and see where they're coming from, and do they make sense, and do we feel good about them, and are we consistent with them? The next section I want to do, and this is slightly a briefer thing, is the question of what is queer sex. The final section what I want to talk about is what is bad sex. What I mean by that is what kind of criteria should we use to judge whether something's right or wrong or a good idea. What I want to suggest in asking what a queer sex is there such a category? In our experience, we do recognize it. Coming back to the lesbian French kissing thing. There's something in our culture that suggests that there's something different about two women doing this exact same act than a man and a woman doing it. And so there is this category out there that we have an intuition that there is something called queer sex. When I teach this subject to law students, my purpose in this section, and by following up the previous section, is to suggest that there is no such thing. That you have the same surface, you have the same orifice, you have the same penetration, and, I mean, there's a hole there. You don't even know if it's a man or a woman's mouth Here's the penis. Does it make a difference? I mean, what I usually try to do is to suggest to people that as a culture, we've created often a very artificial distinction. And so we say that when a woman and a woman love each other and live together and do all these things, that's somehow different in kind from a man and a woman doing the exact same things. What I would like to suggest today is something actually different from that, which is that it does make sense to talk about a category of queer sex. I don't have time to do now, but I have all the stuff from the history of sodomy laws and what is the abominable, detestable crime against nature and all of that. And I want to rush past that, but come up to what I think is really, really another survey. And what do we get? Let's see what we get there. So having said up, suggested there may be a category of something called queer sex. Here's some possible definitions of something queer. Sexual acts other than those between members of the opposite sex. That's queer. How about other than the vanilla missionary position, penis-vagina sex? A lot of people, that's their definition of perverse. And the church has condemnations of perverse sex, even in marriage, whatever that is. Sexual acts between members of the same sex. Sexual acts with someone other than the sex you're usually oriented towards. So if you're a gay man and you're having sex with a woman, that's not natural. I've done it. But vice versa, when you go against your nature. Another one is sexual acts performed by a minority of a person, which I think is often what we're coming from. Most people aren't doing, but really, I often think that the answer is it's something that I wouldn't do, but that other people do. That's queer. So that might be it. Like, people are like bondage stuff, and there's like all this weird stuff out there that I'm just not into. That's queer. Unusual. Or gross. This is actually a very useful category. There are things I think are just really gross. But in some of all of that, though, I would offer, I think it is a valuable thing for Mormons to think about, is out in the real world, I say there is no such thing as queer sex. Queer sex is just something you think is weird or gross. Here, I actually think there is such a thing. Victor Brown, in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, and this is on the homosexuality chapter, it says, the reason why homosexual acts are condemned in the LDS Church in a different way than mere masturbation or premarital sex between straight people is it's they are offensive to God because they repudiate the gift and the giver of eternal life. I would suggest that it does make sense to suggest that there is such a thing as queer sex, and that is sex or sexual conduct, sexual beliefs that violate the assigned gender roles of your society. So if you have a proclamation of the family which talks about gender being eternal, sex where, like, if the woman is in charge might repudiate that. Wearing the wrong clothes might repudiate that. And certainly women having sex with women or men having sex with men are the ultimate repudiation of that. So I think it is meaningful to talk about it, and I think we need to address that, that when we're talking about queer, we are often talking about what our attitudes are about gender roles from society, where they come from, to what extent are they indeed eternal and divine and set by God, and to what extent are they're like grass skirts on men or women depending on our culture. So my final section, and this is the question of what is bad sex. And my purpose in tackling the topic of sexual ethics is I really think that you can identify the kinds of criteria that you use, you think that you should use, or you think that that society should use to evaluate whether a particular sexual act, whether it's sex or something or like sex, is a good idea or not. Some examples from the law. For example, in Illinois, adultery is still illegal, but it's only if you are having sex with someone who is married and it's open and notorious. So this is why we're worried about, like, scaring the horses. We also have other ones. We have legal definitions of prostitution that we think that if you do sexual penetration, which you saw was defined, so and you do it for money, then that's prostitution. So if you're just fooling around and it's not penetration, even if there's money involved, it's not prostitution in Illinois. or this other diet of sexual relations with families, which is incest, we have decided which family categories are repugnant. And we decided that they are, in Illinois, brother, sister, father, mother, whether you're adopted or not, or stepmother or stepfather. I mean, that's just as a society we've decided, because of history and power relations and whatever reason, that that's bad sex. In the church, we have some definitions of bad sex, things that are wrong. One is sexual relations, whatever that is, again, appropriately expressed only within the bond of marriage, which are appropriately expressed. Within marriage, as long as they're not perverse or coercive, again, whatever that is. And again, this definition of homosexuality. So there are definitions out there of whether it's the law or society or the church that suggest of what are those acts. Once we decide what they are, again, it depends on the expression. And often the debate in the church is this double standard where two men kiss is wrong, but a man and a woman, it has to go to some... before you have to confess it to the bishop, it has to be more than that. So what I'm going to do now, and I have, in my final 5 or 10 minutes, I'm going to go through a list of about 70 criteria that we could use to decide whether sex is a good idea or not. And where's number one? Oh, there it is. And so, like I said, there are about 70 of them. I'm going to go through them, and then we're going to go back through them, and everyone gets 7 votes. So you're going to pick, so go through them. Everyone gets to pick the 7 things they think are important enough to make as part of your personal sexual ethics. I'll go through the whole list so you can see what they are, and then we'll go back, and we'll see like if we can get some sort of statistical consolidation, whatever. I'm an English major. I don't know what the language is. So number one, and I think, I hope you all vote for this, whether the conduct is voluntary or coerced. Whether it involves minors or incapacitated persons, whether it involves animals, whether it involves inanimate objects, whether it's involving drugs or alcohol, whether it involves money, whether it involves procreation. And this is the Catholic one. I mean, this is the basis of Catholic decisions about sexual morality, of whether it's possible for there to be procreation. Again, whether you intended it to, whether it's likely, whether it's impossible, whether it involves one person or more than one, whether it involves lots of people, what the sex of the people, the religion, the ages, the consanguinity, which is the technical word for your closeness of family relationship, the race, the body types. I think for me to have sex with a really, really fat person would be gross. But that's just me. That's because I'm skinny. Sexual orientation. Whether the people are one of the people or more are a virgin, whether the medical HIV status, whether you love each other, whether you like each other, whether you're attracted to each other, whether you even know each other, whether you've been really good friends and now you can have sex, whether you were dating before and you had sex. I would say this is a bad thing, but anyway, that's just me. Whether you work together, whether it's your boss, whether it's the first time, whether we're talking about sex, whatever that is for you, or something else like just making out, or oral sex, whatever. The particular acts or positions, whether you're having fun, whether you planned it or not. Like BYU, we're into planning. I bet that's important to some people. How frequent it is, how long it takes, how skillful the people are at it, whether you are professionals or amateurs. Whether it's public or private, whether it's romantic or not, whether it's kinky or vanilla, whatever that means to you, whether you're doing something or just watching it, whether it hurts or not, whether it's consistent with what society thinks you should do, whether it's likely to transmit HIV, whether it's likely to transmit other diseases, whether it threatens public health, whether it presents you or the partner's health, whether you have an orgasm, whether the one or more other people involved have an orgasm, whether it's sanctioned by the Old Testament, the Gospels, the Epistles, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, by modern prophets, the current prophet, by other random general authorities, by people who are not general authorities but are church leaders, by medical professionals, whether it's legal. Like adultery is like gay sex is illegal. Actually, oral sex is illegal in Illinois, in Utah for straight people too. So to feel better about it. Oral sex is illegal like in 12 states. Whether you're married or not, whether you're in a relationship or not, whether the person you're in a relationship knows you're having sex with this person, whether the person you're having, that your partner approves of whether you're having sex with this person, whether this needs to be confessed to someone, either your bishop or your wife, whether it makes you feel guilty, whether it makes you feel embarrassed, whether it makes you feel satisfied, and finally, whether it makes you feel sad or happy. So Rebecca, you keep. I'm going to go zip through those, and this will be almost the end of my presentation. Everyone gets up to 7 votes. So you can pick which the things you were important, and I just want to see where we cluster. So but back to number one. Zipping through. Yes. Well, do you think if you had to pick the 7 most important factors in deciding whether an action is right for you, what would they be? I mean, and you have to pick 7. So I mean, and you can't vote for your favorite one 7 times. You got to pick 7 different ones. Well, wrong. Whether it's wrong, whether I mean, good or bad ethically, personally wrong. I mean, I think that, I mean, some things are wrong because they're wrong for everybody. Some things are wrong because they're wrong for you. Whether it's a factor, either way. I mean, if you think sex should be painful, you should vote for it. And if you think sex should be not painful, you should vote for it. So you don't have to express your opinion on whether you like kinky or vanilla. You just have to express your opinion of whether it's important today, whether the sex you have is kinky or vanilla. So, okay. Everyone knows the ground rules. We're just going to go quickly through these. Try and get I just want to see if there's like a trend. I have no idea what the answers are. And I'll vote 6 or 7 times. Whether volunteer coerced. So we'll call that pretty much everybody. Yes. Right. What those things? Out of all these, right. That you're going to plan your life. This weekend, if we go dancing tonight, this is okay. So we have. Let's say there are like 10, 20, like 40 people in the room. So we'll go by percentages of 40. So 40 people voted for voluntary coerce. Minors are incapacitated people. I'm voting for that. So that's pretty 40. Animals. Anyone want to waste one of theirs on animals? Let's say 15 people think that the animals thing is a factor. Whether you're using tools or not, we are different from animals because we use tools. Tools important to anybody? Nope, no one. Alcohol. Anyone think that the role of alcohol is on the high on the list? One person there, two. Drugs. Oh, I should use this. I'm so bad because I'm like looking at this. Okay, drugs. Did we get some votes? 3 on drugs. Whether it's prostitution. I mean, let's call a spade a spade. Prostitution, is that important to you? So okay, that's like 15 people there. Whether you actually get pregnant with this particular act. Okay, whether it's likely to result in procreation. So you want to know the intent? No, intents. Do you? Is it important tonight whether you plan on having a baby or not? Anyone? That's one. Okay. Whether it's let me collapse these. Whether the likelihood of getting pregnant, is that important to you? I hope it is. Anyone? You want to? I'm putting that in mind, and I'm gay. Okay, whether it's just you or if there's anyone else in the room, is that important? Wow, did you get the pamphlet about the factories and that? That's well, okay. Whether there's just two people, more than two people, is this important to you? Like, are you into orgies? Do you judge orgies? How many people? Number of people, is that important? So we got like. 8 people on that. Well, I didn't say this is going to be easy. I'm trying to prioritize. That's the point. Everyone's like all or nothing. It's sex or it's not sex. It's good or bad. I'm just saying that some things are more bad than others. The sex of your partner, that's important to me. Okay, that's like two-thirds of the room. That's important to people. The religion of the person, that's not important to me. Okay. Anybody? The religion, wow, seven is not very many. You're right. That's the age of the person involved. That's important. So, well, okay. Assuming that they're over 18. Okay. Assuming they're over 18. Okay. So no one other than myself. This is I tend to date guys who are too young. Okay. This two of us had that problem. The body type. Whether you're related to this person. That, I think that's a big thing. Yeah, it's like kissing your sister. That's disgusting. We got about everyone in there. The race of the person. The race of the person. I think that wouldn't have been the same answer a few years ago. The body type. I don't think that's important. Oh wow, age and body type. Bob, too. The marital status of the person involved. This is important to me. So we picked up about two-thirds there. Yes, I should be circling these. I have my magic marker, and I didn't get it out. I'm just not very good with handouts.
I can see it above. Seven's not enough.
I hope you're not cheating. The orientation of the person involved. I mean, you're not going to like corrupt straight guys, okay? whether the person's a virgin or not. And it used to be that's a very 50s thing, whether the person's a virgin. Whether the person is, what the HIV or medical status of the person. So that's like two-thirds there. Whether you love each other. Like, that's only half. Wow. I have to say, okay, we're saying, if you only had seven, that's not, whether you like each other. Some people... whether you're attracted to each other. I think it's important. I don't think you should have... I shouldn't be having sex with someone if I'm not attracted. It says something about me. Whether you know each other, whether you're friends... that's important. Yeah. I'm running out of time, so let's just like go through these quickly. Okay. Attracted to each other. Know each other. We did that. Whether you were friends before, whether you've dated before, quick with the hands. Whether you work together, whether your boss, first time, whether it was sex versus not sex. That's important to me. There are things I won't do with other people besides my boyfriend. Particular acts involved. Whether it's fun. Now I hope that you, out of your seven, you save one for fun. Oh, I am so sad. Planned, spontaneous, frequent. I think that's what you discovered. Well, let me just go to the last page then, where we have whether public or private. So a couple of people like don't feel like we should like. Several people don't think we should go outside. Romantic, unromantic. Yes. Yes. What I'm saying is that everybody acts on the basis of standards where they were come from, and I'm asking us all to identify what those standards are. I think at the end of when you look through the list, you will find something else about yourself or about society based on that. Well, I'm actually out of time, so I'm not going to do this anymore. But what I am going to do is two last slides, since my secretary went to the bother of making them. The first one is, when I was a missionary, we had a pamphlet called "Why Stay Morally Clean." We always say, "Well, it's like why stay morally clean?" My answer to that, it is not a rhetorical question. I think that sex is very important, and I think that the choices we make about sex are very important. I'm not suggesting that everyone should have the same values or based on the same thing as I do, but I think that we all need to recognize that, and that there is such a thing as wrong, right and wrong in the sexual conduct. That there are choices you make which will have consequences which you need to recognize, but it's also worthwhile to identify where they come from. Where did my last favorite slide go? Oh, they all do. No, that's okay. I'll be all right. There it is. Actually, if I were to sum it all up, I would say, this is from a poster campaign we put in the buses all over Chicago. It's like, gosh darn it, just be the...
Roger, for the great comments and sort of the ease with which we can start to talk about sex. He hit on some good points. It seems to be, it's very titillating, and it's exciting. It's something that we sometimes scare away from talking about. But his presentation enabled us to think about it in very frank terms. I am quickly going to present a short paper, a piece of philosophical work I've been working on that will give a more... a structured framework for how do we analyze sexual ethics, particularly, not so much sexual acts. The ethical system that the church provides for us is what philosophers call deontological. That means that what is right or wrong comes from God, and then it also comes from your belief in God and belief in the prophets of God. The law, by contrast, is basically consequential, although there's some other factors involved. But so when there's legal definitions of what sex is appropriate or inappropriate, it's usually based on what consequences we think are appropriate or inappropriate. And particularly with incest, we think that the consequence of harming a child is inappropriate. So that type of sex is inappropriate. I would like to argue that regardless of one's faith in the church or sexual practice, inquiry into sexual attitude is very important. And from here on, I'll try to read this paper, and I apologize if it's a little dry. Sexual attitude is the subjective posture one adopts in relation to one's partner. Regardless of one's faith in LDS church or sexual practices, ethical inquiry into sexual attitude still deserves examination. The most pressing problem for sexual attitude is that of objectification. Objectification prohibits us from treating the other morally, showing respect, or expressing love. When sexual desire is involved, these questions arise. Does sexual desire necessarily objectify one's partner? How does one reconcile love and objectification? In what follows, I will briefly explore the meaning of desire, objectification, and love very briefly, and hope to provide a conceptual framework for personal introspection. Ultimately, I will advocate that we attempt to adopt a balanced attitude between love and desire while preserving an acute awareness of the ease with which we objectify. Since mine will be a narrow analysis of sexual attitudes, I will focus primarily on sexual ethics within a love relationship. This will exclude any ethical questions pertaining to recreational sex or casual sex, that is, the sexual acts performed outside of a love relationship. Now, this type of bracketing off might not be accepted by some, but it's how I frame the analysis. Instead, I will focus on the points of contact in sexual experience at which the subjectivity and desires of each person meet. Sex is symbiotic or interactive. In pleasuring one's partner, one might also experience self-pleasure and vice versa. Symbiosis enables objectification. When we realize that our sexual interaction brings about self-pleasure, we might ask, am I using my partner as a means to achieve self-pleasure? Perhaps we believe that our sexual relations are a mutual expression of love and affection, when in actuality, pleasure and gratification motivate our actions. If personal pleasure is the only motivation in sexual relations, then one's partner's experience is irrelevant, insofar as it does not contribute to one's own pleasure. To deny the importance of one's partner's subjective experience is to objectify that person. The denial or ignorance of one partner's experience is perhaps an expression of one's lack of love, affection, respect, or caring. In contrast, to treat one's partner as a person is to regard his or her interests and experiences as requiring action that is independent of one's own desires. Does sexual desire necessarily objectify one's partner? The background issue for this question concerns the relationship between love and sexual desire for one's partner. How are sex and love linked? Michel Foucault, in addressing social disdain for homosexuality in the early 1980s, argued that homosexuality only becomes a threat to, quote, sanitize society when a homosexual way of life emerges. This way of life for Foucault incorporates affection, friendship, fidelity, companionship, and tenderness. In other words, when homosexuality ceases to be defined by the sex act alone, but includes relationships of love and the formation of new alliances and the tying together of unforeseen lines of force, end quote, does the homosexual way of life threaten straight society? For Foucault, the strength and power of relationships is found in the more emotive commitments of friendship and fidelity, what I would call spiritual commitments. Milan Kundera writes, sex is merely the territory love marks out for itself. If this is the case, we can surmise that sex is a territory in human experience distinguishable from love, and further, that it is many times our inclination to join the experience of sex with feelings of love. It seems that love is a power distinct from the territory of sex. But why, then, does love take sex as its territory? Frequently, sexual desire is thought to be analogous to hunger. They are both appetites of the body that need to be satiated. While this analogy might work for biologists or sociologists discussing sexuality, it fails to take into account the subjective states of each person involved. While eating, we experience the taste, texture, and pleasure of food, just as in sex, we experience various degrees of pleasure and perhaps pain. But unlike sex, eating is generally not associated with emotional expression or individual responses. Often in sexual relations, we desire interaction with our partner. We desire their responses to us, their expressions of pleasure. We also desire shared experience in the fullest sense. Sex becomes a project of intimacy once both partners attempt to achieve a closeness that produces private knowledge of the other. In this way, sex is thought of as union or an attempt to unify subjective experiences. Love for one's partner many times leads to desire for intimacy, and specifically, sexual intimacy or the embodied contact of persons. Intimacy is many times held as an ideal for love relationships. It is characterized by trust, fidelity, and understanding. For Plato, the goal of love was to achieve communion with true beauty, simple and divine, end quote. Sexual desire for Plato is on par with animal passions. We no longer and will only impede our contemplation of beauty. In modern discussions of sexual desire, we no longer talk in terms of animal passions or the need to transcend our natural appetites. Sexual desire is not immoral in itself. We no longer condemn passion for passion's sake. Instead, the concern with sexual desire has shifted to concern over the loss of respect and autonomy that comes with objectification. In a sense, objectification, when linked with sexual desire, is another spin on the notion that sex is an irrational, base, and potentially harmful activity. Martha Nussbaum, in her book, Sex and Social Justice, recently analyzed objectification by categorizing it into several forms. Her analysis is motivated by Kant, who writes, "Sexual love is a degradation of human nature, for as soon as a person becomes an object of appetite for another, all motive of moral relationship cease to function, because as an object of appetite for another person, that person becomes a thing that can be treated and used as such by everyone." In other words, sexual desire, by its nature, objectifies the person desired. Objectification nullifies moral relationships because we simply cannot stand in moral relation to things. For Kant, the problem with objectification is not simply an issue of one partner objectifying the other, but that the objectification is mutual and voluntary. We wish to be objectified in order to be included in a relationship that brings about our own pleasure by the inevitable objectification of self and partner. The challenge then arises. Can a moral relationship be preserved when sexual relations are maintained, or are all sexual relations immoral acts of objectification? Or is it possible to desire a loved one and refrain from harmful objectification? Disentangling desire from objectification is a difficult task because desire is an intentional state. We have desires for things, but not all desires are for things. In contrast with this more possessive desire, we have desires that certain events or situations come about. We have desires to care for people, to express love, fidelity, and friendship. I would propose that sexual relations involve two levels of desiring, what I would call expressive desire and attractive desire. Expressive desire is that desire that we express through physical actions. For example, we might make breakfast for a lover, remembering particular preferences for eggs, and by our physical actions, we hope to convey love and caring. Likewise, in sexual relations, we might remember a particular caress that our lover enjoys, and in doing so, hope to convey love. The second level of desire I call attractive desire, and this one runs the risk of objectification. Attractive desire is attraction without any specific desire to express love. At this level, love expression may be underlying but is not requisite. In analyzing our own subjective sexual attitude, we need to ask ourselves, are all or most of our sexual encounters dominated by attractive desire? Do we find ourselves seeking pleasure for ourselves instead of expressing love for our partner? Although these two levels of desire might appear to be an accessible tool for introspection, the question of objectification has not been solved. Kant believed that any sexual desire was an objectifying appetite that must be transcended in order to maintain moral relationships. I would argue that we need not overcome sexual desire in order to maintain a moral relationship. Instead, the pre-existing moral relationship between two persons transforms the objectifying nature of sexual desire into a source of love expression. In the desire to express love to another physically, we first must have the feelings of love prefaced by respect. The moral relationship between two people, rational and autonomous beings for Kant, must first exist in order to have and express feelings of love and respect. To say that personhood evaporates via the objectifying power of sex once the expression of love is made is to claim that sex has the power to invalidate attitudes of love and respect. I would argue that subjective attitudes take precedent over and color the morality attached to actions, not the other way around. Since sexual desire is compatible with the desire to express love, that is, sex is a tool for love expression, we cannot reject sexual desire out of hand as immoral. But caution, we have not solved a philosophical problem. Sex is not free from objectification. Since it is possible that objectifying desire can eclipse expressive desire, we must constantly question our attitude in sexual relations. But on the other hand, we do not have to shy away from sexual relations because they necessarily objectify our partner or obscure our feelings and expressions of love. It might be the case that a desire to express love, care, and tenderness keeps the harmful effects of objectivity in check. However, I am remorse to admit that the struggle between love and desire is not easily subdued. Balancing the two is a task that requires extreme depth of introspection, honesty, and hard work. For philosophers, the work is only in its infancy. Thank you.
I want to thank both Roger and Rebecca for their work in opening up a topic which, obviously, as Roger mentioned, has a lot of interest for all of us. We have time for about one question really quickly. You ready?
They're not very good at making
decisions. Okay. there? Yes. Go ahead. Okay. Well, the comment, can I repeat it? Just that, according to Rebecca's thesis, sex is only appropriate within a love relationship, and even then only as you continue to examine your own motivations in terms of avoiding objectification.
Yeah, I think that the second half is right, that what I'm trying to propose is that the ethical position we should take in sexual relations is that of not objectifying our partner. But whether we can maintain a non-objectifying attitude in recreational sex, which I say is without a love relationship, something that's consensual but there aren't emotions involved, I'm not sure. I think that that's why I bracketed it. I'm not sure that objectification necessarily comes into play when it's something that's consensual and not in a love relationship. Because some modern philosophers think that respect for the person can still be maintained even if we don't have love for them. And that would be not solving the objectification problem.
Mm-hmm.
And why would that be?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying. No, that's yeah. No, that's what
just
I was saying.
Let me.
Is the, I'm sorry. Then it could be more.
The comment is that perhaps love is not the only criteria. That as was said, maybe respect, maybe liking, maybe there are other degrees other than love that make it a justifiable relationship.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I mean, I think that that's a different philosophical problem that I haven't worked out why it is that mutuality nullifies objectivity. I haven't worked that out. But and it could be. It could be, yeah.
Okay.
It does seem to me that you've got the same problem with love.
Well, define your terms.
Oh, yeah.
What is the definition? You're welcome to stay afterwards to talk with Roger and Rebecca, but thank you very much.